We, the taxpayers, could be on the hook for some money in planning for the RNC in Jacksonville. Duval schools have been muzzled from putting out COVID data, even as free tests for students begin. And Amazon brings a new facility and hundreds of jobs to town. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, Generation W going virtual this season. We'll tell you about it. But first, it's Friday. Here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Great to have you. Tim Gibbons, who edits the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning.
Regular contributor Fred Matthews with us once again. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And rounding out our foursome, WJCT digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning, everyone.
So good to have you all with us. Lots of news to get into this week, but first, here is the latest on the pandemic across the state. There are 11,650 deaths in Florida reported due to coronavirus. 472 deaths in our area with more than 40,000 cases. Now, of course, the coronavirus pandemic is the reason why the Republican National Convention almost came to Jacksonville and also why it ended up not coming here in the end. Remember all this? President Trump pulled the RNC out of Charlotte, North Carolina, when that state wouldn't allow him to crowd people into a convention hall with no social distancing or masks. Jacksonville then wooed the president to come here. Local business owners then sued. They said it would be a COVID super spreader event. Finally, the Trump campaign pulled the plug, and they held the RNC mostly in Washington, D.C. But all along, Duval taxpayers were promised they would not foot the bill for a cent of the RNC here. However, this week, the Times Union reports the city could still end up absorbing $154,000 in convention planning expenses. This was according to information given Wednesday to members of the city council. More than half of that cost would have been for overtime pay for employees prepping for the convention. Now, we still don't know how much the private host committee even raised to bring the RNC to town, although multiple published reports said they were having a very hard time raising money for the event. This kicks off our media roundtable this Friday. Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. The Democratic National Convention, of course, aired for four nights on TV, then the RNC for four nights. And much of the RNC took place at an empty venue in Washington, D.C., where speakers spoke to the camera. And then on the final night, the president and his family spoke at the White House, a violation of the Hatch Act, by the way. But it was interesting watching that from here in Jacksonville, because all of that could have taken place here. We were told all along that no taxpayers would have to foot the bill for the RNC. We've learned now, though, that that's probably wasn't the case. So if the RNC had come to town, it's hard to estimate, you know, how much we would have ended up having to pay, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's hard to estimate since the promise was zero and the result is not. But, you know, it makes sense because there is nothing that costs nothing, you know, to plan for. I think what David Barline from the Times Union found is that, you know, much of this money that happened, it was planning costs for the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, because, you know, trying to put together a massive event like that requires a huge amount of staff time. And, you know, I think we all reported during the planning phase how much time it was taking for the sheriff out of his daily calendar to participate in meetings, which, you know, at a time of the, you know, record-setting homicide spike and all of the other challenges that they're facing right now at the JSO in terms of COVID impacts and protests, probably not, you know, the best way to spend your time in meetings planning for a political event. But, you know, it does cost money for those people to sit down. It's staff time, and they're all, you know, fairly well compensated. So it is a big chunk of change.
It is. We should note Anne is actually in court right now. Once she signs off with us, she's going to be covering a court case. So we're doing the best we can to connect her with the technology we have. Tim Gibbons, you know, if the convention had come to Jacksonville, the city would have had to pay out tens of millions of dollars for security expenses. They were promised a federal grant to be reimbursed for that, for manpower and equipment. There was a private host committee trying to raise money, although we did hear that they were having trouble raising money right before the president pulled the plug on the RNC in Jacksonville. What are your thoughts about all this?
Right. They were having trouble raising money, although you would expect that they raised at least, you know, 100 grand if the city was seeking to be reimbursed by somebody for this time. I think it's important, though, to separate out the money paid for staff time, as well as an outside contractor who basically helped with this. So they're, you know, the city's reviewing that invoice. They haven't paid it yet, but that actually would be cash money. Clearly, it's just a drop in the bucket when you look at the city budget. And the city does spend money on, you know, any large event. Obviously, staff work on that. But this was something that was a purely political thing that ends up with taxpayers paying part of it.
Yeah, Fred Matthews, that's right. As Tim pointed out, there was a firm hired to help the city of Jax comply with federal grants tied to the convention. They billed the city about $70,000. Should the city pay that invoice? That's taxpayer money for an event that did not happen here because it was so controversial due to the pandemic.
Well, this is one of those issues that falls squarely on the executive branch of government. As was said by the mayor's executive assistant there, the chief of staff at the very beginning of this. This was no different than any other special event that comes out of the special events department. And any of us that have thrown a festival, a music festival, or downtown event, you know you have to go through that special events department to get things done. Now, the only thing that was really unusual about this particular special event was that it was a nationwide event that was going to be taking place in Jacksonville, and it was going to require much more time of the staff than usual. The fact that the event holders had a team of their own that was supposedly helping them to raise money was, again, the same thing as any other group would have that was going to put on an event in any of the public facilities around town. The thing that was so different here is that we knew that the cost of this event and the safety of it for the folks attending the event and for the local public was going to run into much more money than would be a normal event. And then to hold that, how much it was actually going to cost away from the public for as long as they have, was what was not quite in the norm. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised. I don't think anybody's surprised at the money. It's not that much when you consider how much is really actually probably would have been spent on this thing. But again, we were promised that the public basically would not be paying anything. And now we find out that they are.
That's right. I think that's why it's worth discussing. And Bill Bortsfield, let's get your thoughts on this. Public polling on the RNC before the plug got pulled showed that the majority of Jacksonville residents did not want the event to come. They were worried about spread of the virus and also protests. And they didn't like the thought of taxpayers potentially having to foot the bill. But as Fred points out, you know, we're footing the bill, we the taxpayers, for all kinds of events that go on all of the time that don't get as much attention as this one got. That is something else to note.
It is, but we also, our mayor really lobbied hard for this, and he told us that, you know, we should expect that money was going to be reimbursed. I mean, back in June, I pulled up one of the stories, and we've got a quote in it where he says, quote, "We've always gotten reimbursed and gotten reimbursed timely," referring to what he expected to get back. And, of course, we all remember the prediction of $100 million economic impact to the region, which, of course, got scaled back as we got closer. But I think many in the in political circles, in the private sector, really questioned that number way back in the beginning, even when it was first touted, because everyone knew we were already in the throes of the pandemic, and it left a lot of people scratching their head. And I don't think too many people were surprised at the way this actually ended up playing out. And, you know, I am curious to see if we will hear the mayor address this sometime soon, now that some numbers are coming out. And of course, one thing we don't know is what the private sector might have invested. We don't know, for example, if maybe some T-shirts were printed up, or how much planning, you know, local hotels and JTA and all the rest had already committed to this event before the plug was pulled.
All great points. It's our Friday roundtable. Do you think the city should have to pay $154,000 in expenses related to planning the Republican National Convention here in town? That's what we, the taxpayers, could end up paying for the event that did not happen here in the end. 549-2937, Rick in Murray Hill. Hi, Rick. Good morning.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I want to say I'm absolutely online with the vast majority of Jacksonvillians who say we shouldn't be on the line for a dime of this. I have to disagree with your panelists who said, well, this is not a lot of money and we pay out for other things. This is a partisan political event. There's nothing more, nothing less than a monument to the political ambition and the egos of Donald Trump and Mayor Curry. We need to remember that Mayor Curry amassed a $3 million war chest, or better, when he had no opponent. He's a political operator, not a man of the people or anything else. He's looking for his partisan political advantage. And I would add that the, you know, Republican administrations of the city have a bad habit of coming up with these great ideas, spending tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of taxpayer money just planning things that never come up. So the well-heeled, well-connected vendors do well, and the taxpayers pay for the notes. Thank you.
Rick, thanks. Ann Schindler, I think that that caller summed up why this whole notion was unpopular in the community, because it was perceived as partisan. The mayor was asked, would you lobby this hard for the Democratic National Convention to come to Jacksonville? And he said that he would because of the economic opportunities. But that said, there were just so many health concerns associated with it that you did have to wonder why they pursued it so aggressively.
Yeah, I mean, while this was a partisan event, the objections to it were pretty nonpartisan. I mean, it was across the board, Republicans and Democrats concerned about bringing in, you know, any fuel to the fire in terms of, you know, protests, but also the disease. And there were, you know, a couple of related lawsuits against the city and JSO that I don't believe we've calculated the cost for that either, frankly. I mean, the settlement that the city had to do with the protesters who sued in advance of the RNC in federal court, JSO agreed not only to change some of its policing policies, but to pay $100,000. So that's another $100,000 that this potential event, you know, may have, I mean, obviously that stems from prior protests, but it was in the context of this coming protest that they were allowed to bring that litigation. And I would just point out in terms of the, what we don't know that, that Bill was talking about a minute ago, there's still so much we don't know. And I think it was Tim Gibbons actually who reported, you know, a couple months ago, he asked for any documents related to, you know, bringing that event to town, any, you know, draft of a contract, any notes or negotiations. And he was told there are none. I mean, when you talk about an event of this magnitude, the idea that two city top staff sat down and have no notes or memos or texts or emails related to bringing the RNC to town, it's just not plausible.
Yeah. Tim Gibbons, can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, the Business Journal requested basically anything. I think we included any faxes in there just in case, you know, you never know. But I think that that's part of, when you go back to the outrage over this amount, when we keep on saying it's not a lot in relative terms, that's just because of the size of the city budget, but it is a lot compared to zero, which is what they said. And it is the idea that it were city workers at City Hall putting their time in on this event that was not seen as something wanted by the community. You know, you compare it to a big event like Florida Georgia or Jazz Fest. Yes, clearly they have costs of city staff work that go into it as well. But those are events that Jacksonville as a community wants here. So that makes it different. And the idea that those city employees had no records, we were told that everything they did was done over the phone or in person, which, you know, is the type of thing that frankly raises some suspicions amongst, you know, journalist sorts. But also just it kind of begs the question of, well, what was the result of all of that work that the staff members put in?
549-2937 to join our Friday roundtable. Ronald at the beaches. Hello, Ronald. Happy almost weekend. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, my basic comment would be is I don't understand why for a political event, the city should have to pay anything. The RNC should ante up and pay the whole bill. It was a political event. It had, you know, the city, it would be on the spotlight, but so what? I mean, the Republican National Committee should be the one paying for this whole thing.
Thank you, Ronald. Fred Matthews, what about that? Should the city kick it to the Republican National Committee?
The city council can take a vote and say, no, we're not going to pay it. Send it back, send it to the committee that put it on. They could do that with a simple, 10 votes. But the question is, will they do it? You know, the key members of the city council did come out, as I recall, in support of this measure. And as we all know, the majority vote on the city council is Republican. And they have had up until this point, with the exception of electing Tommy Hazuri as council president, who is a Democrat and former mayor and they can simply vote to not pay this bill and send it back to the host committee to take it on. But the question is, will they do it? Will they do it? Do they, you know, is it significant enough for them to take it on and do it? And if they aren't hearing from their constituents, my guess is that this will go to the finance committee and be buried there. We may not hear anything more about it, but the council can say no.
549-2937. Lots of calls on this hot topic this Friday on our media roundtable. John on the South Side. Hello, John.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you so much for taking my call, and good morning to your distinguished panel. I hope that my question will be construed as, Jax, it's easier here.
Okay.
But when I saw the invoice on the TV, it seemed to me that there was a line for ethics, just a couple thousand bucks. So what was entailed with that expenditure? Did that include one meeting? Was it all the meetings? And maybe it has been reported, but maybe if your panel can just expand on that, or was that a type up?
Okay, John, thanks. Here's an email about this as well from Teresa. How could there be City Hall overtime for planning the RNC? I thought employees whose jobs were furloughed were being used for this. Okay. Bill Bortsfield, you know, the perception that the public isn't getting a transparent picture of all of this, although the council auditor, to be clear, did submit this information publicly to the city council reps. So we are getting at least that information. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, as far as transparency goes, I mean, I think it's going to depend on how much the city council breaks down that report hour by hour. You know, I mean, for example, the word overtime may or may not apply in some cases. I mean, you have billable hours. So if you have a city worker on straight time that, you know, spends 4 hours on a project versus, saying, planning a sidewalk or whatever the case may be, that's still, you know, billable time, whether it's overtime or not. I mean, I think we really need to hear from some key people on this. Number one, our mayor. Number two, and or the Duval and or state Republican Party, and have them come out and say, well, you know, yes, the host committee, or yes, we are going to get reimbursed for federal funds, or no, we're not. We really do need to hear that. Now, until that happens and until City Hall digs into it, I do think we have to have an open mind because, I mean, now that we're hearing some numbers, again, the question does become, does the city pay that or not? That's what's owed. But let's see whether it does at some point get reimbursed via the host committee or federal sources or the Republican Party, or whether the city is indeed the final one on the hook for the bill.
A listener emails the show, the RNC was a partisan event. Why should taxpayers foot the bill? Let's take one more call on this, and then we'll move on to some other news and notes from the week. John, another John in San Marco. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for your work.
Sure. Thank you. Go ahead. What are your thoughts?
I know these are two different subjects, but if it's $150,000 that we lost, and yet this week we got $14 million federal dollars for our fire department, then I think, wow, that's great. We're up $14 million. But my real question would be, last weekend there were five shootings in Jacksonville. How many shootings do you think there'll be the next three-day weekend?
Thanks for that, John. And you're right. In the midst of all these other news headlines, the high homicide and gun violence rate in the city, the drumbeat of that just keeps continuing on. And Schindler, we are heading into a holiday weekend, and let's hope for a peaceful Labor Day weekend. But sadly, we know from hard experience that that is not the case usually. And, you know, it's become such a fact of life in this city that we don't always focus enough media attention on it. It's a continuous failure of this city's institutions to truly get a handle on the incredibly high gun violence and murder rate that we are saddled with in Jacksonville, Florida.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's a little mind-numbing for everyone. I think the people who live in those communities that are under siege, as well as, you know, the media, I think it's really hard to find the solutions when, you know, you're kind of approaching it from the front end of the gun. You know, there's so many root causes to systemic violence. I think after studying it for 50 years, we kind of know the deal. We know what helps. We know that, you know, early interventions are important, that poverty exacerbates crime, that, you know, education helps diminish crime, that, you know, caring families are really necessary and support for those families. But for some reason, you know, getting that kind of dedicated funding has been difficult for this city and for a lot of cities. And when you're dealing with something that's ingrained, you know, by the time somebody is 15 or 16 years old and they've grown up in some neighborhoods where gun violence is a daily event, it's a little hard to intervene at that point and make big changes. It really does become, you know, a vicious cycle.
Thanks for that. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, a look back at the top local and regional stories of the week here on First Coast Connect with Ann Schindler of First Coast News, Tim Gibbons of the Jacksonville Business Journal, regular analyst and contributor Fred Matthews, and our WJCT digital editor Bill Bortsfield, and yours truly. We're going to shift gears now and talk about some other headlines from the week. We learned this week that there will be free and relatively rapid tests for COVID-19 available for students in all Duval County public schools. That's good news. At the same time, though, the state has muzzled the local school district from publishing how many positive cases they actually have in area schools. Let us know your thoughts about this, especially if you're a parent or a teacher out there. It's 549-2937. Tim Gibbons, we're a few weeks into the school year, and teachers, parents, kids, we're all in the dark about how many COVID cases exist in the school district. The health department muzzled school officials. They tried to publish positive cases and then were told not to.
I think not to connect the last story to this one, but that idea of transparency, and these are organizations that work for us and people need to make decisions and need information to do that, kind of does seem like a thread. The issue with the school district of obviously schools are going on, students are back in school, working parents are dealing with, you know, how they manage those things. Having the information obviously makes making decisions easier. And they're just not releasing it. It has become quite a thing. We talk particularly to working parents who are trying to decide, you know, do they keep their kids home? Do they send their kids to school? They want to have that information to make those decisions.
Absolutely. Fred Matthews, Tim's right. All of our lives have been upended by this pandemic, and we need information. Everybody does. We need good information to make good decisions so that we can protect ourselves and our loved ones. And we're not always getting it, which is very alarming.
Well, it has to be puzzling to anyone, especially here as we sit and watch this in the state of Florida, that we have two seemingly opposing views among to gather them together, three events. We have the education department. We have the regulation department, the health department for the state of Florida weighing in on this. And then we have the local school districts like our own who are trying to manage this issue and who have boots on the ground with it. And we have one group says, no, don't release that information. The other group says, yes, it's okay to release the information. And we have a third group that's already just trying to keep the kids and the teachers safe while they're in class. And it is just puzzling to me why anybody would want to hide or hold back information from the public that has to do directly with their safety, except that it has to come down to some political advantage that we have, especially for the current state government administration. They seem to always, they've moved into the mode now of only releasing information that makes them look good. And when it comes to the COVID-19 issue, they don't want any information to get out that seems to make it look like they're not managing things well.
549-2937, Joel in Duval County. Joel, good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yes, I think that this is a really negative thing, them not releasing the information, and they're politicizing once again something that should be scientifically handled, and they need to release the information so people can make it their own intelligent decisions.
Thank you, Joel. Bill Bortsfield, certainly we're hearing that from a lot of parents and teachers as well.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, my kids now are out of the public school system, and I'm very thankful for that, because I'll tell you, if my kids were still in grade school, high school, this is something I very much would want to know, because every parent cares tremendously about their kids and what's going on, and obviously the risk it brings into the home too for parents and grandparents. And you know, I got to applaud the district for trying to do this. And you know, before the system was shut down, the district, and now this data is getting old, but at the time the district was saying there was one confirmed case at Dinsmore Elementary of a student. There was a case involving a staff member at Highlands Middle. Landon College Preparatory had one student that was confirmed with a case, and the Young Women's Men's Leadership Academy had one case confirmed. And again, this, you know, and it's not to say that you want to panic, but you want to be aware as a parent. I mean, and you want to, if you've had somebody that just came home from surgery or is immune deficient, this is important information for families to have. I really hope we see that soon the state and the districts will get together and get this going again, because this is important information.
Anna emails the show, I've been pondering why they would muzzle the schools and health workers to release the data. The only thing I can come up with is that they are trying to prevent mass hysteria, but it doesn't make sense to me. You know, Ann Schindler, the health department's position to withhold this data is at odds with federal guidance from the U.S. Department of Education. They say districts can report state numbers as long as they don't identify individual students. So really, there's no public health reason not to release this data to the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly no compelling reason. You know, and the mayor was asked about this at a press conference last week. And he said, as a parent, he would like to have that information, but then he kind of deflected and said, but I don't know their protocols and I haven't really looked into it. You know, we might remember at the start of this COVID epidemic, the mayor was unable to get information from the local health department, which really isn't local anymore. It's, you know, just run out of Tallahassee. But he couldn't get answers about, you know, any of the data. And he was frustrated. He had to start implementing a citywide shutdown without knowing those figures. And so, you know, his hands were tied. And I guess, you know, I'm a little surprised that he isn't using his bully pulpit to kind of as leverage in this. He's obviously a very powerful mayor, a rare Republican mayor under a Republican governor. And, you know, if he's got concerns with students of his, you know, his kids in school, and I'm sure he can empathize with all of the other parents out there that have those same concerns, you know, why not demand it? I mean, he did, you know, he did when at the start of this thing, he expressed his displeasure that he wasn't able to get answers and his frustration. And, you know, I think that helped generate some movement.
Henry emails the show, is there anyone that can sue to have this information released? Tim Gibbons, could parents do a class action to try to get this information?
That's a very good question. There's always an issue of standing in situations like this, and I'm not a lawyer and don't actually have a firm answer on that, but that is the question of who directly is harmed. And I'm sure that there are people, hopefully maybe some who are listening to the show right now, who might, you know, work in the legal profession who could have a firm answer for that.
Yeah, we do need to know that.
But the time it would take to run through litigation as opposed to the first couple weeks when we're either going to see a spike or not is, you know, would put this, it just wouldn't be practical.
Right. Thank you for that.
Yep.
Lots of folks named John calling in. John on the South Side. Hi, John.
How you doing, Miss Melissa?
I'm great.
I just wanted to remind your listeners that we got to play connect the dots here. All right. First, we had the COVID and we was being touted. Oh, we're doing such a great job. And then things went to turning left. Then all of a sudden, we got rid of the one lady that was doing the board that was putting in the numbers. And then they said, oh, well, she wasn't doing right, this and that.
Yeah, a woman named Rebecca Jones. Out. Yeah, okay.
Yes, ma'am, Ms. Jones. Okay, so now then the next dot, we come up, President Trump runs and say, oh, well, the schools must open. Now what everybody got to realize is that if the American students and American people does not go to the schools, that what happens is you have monies pulled back. You have your state monies pulled, then you have federal monies pulled. So it boils down to really about money. Now, when it comes to them basically reporting the numbers, they have always been trying to skew the numbers. Number one, we all say, oh, the kids don't catch COVID, and they're not going to be the ones that are asymptomatic and pass it on. Yet, we are all parents, and we know seeing a child, and they just got a regular cold. By the end of the day, three or four other kids got it.
Yeah, and some kids can get sick with it, and some kids have died. John, you made and thank you for all your points, John. That's John on the South Side. Fred Matthews, you know, he's correct that school districts were threatened in Florida with the loss of state funding if they didn't open brick and mortar schools 5 days a week. There is an active lawsuit on behalf of Florida teachers who don't all want to go back into the physical classroom. On the other hand, let's point out that there is now free and rapid testing for all Duval County school students who want it for COVID-19. And we are starting to see the numbers slowly inch downward for coronavirus in our area. Some good news to report. I did want to get that in as well. Your thoughts?
I think it's excellent news to report, and it's again another testament to the leadership of the local school board that we have now that has been quite proactive in taking care of these issues. And despite some concern at the very beginning between the superintendent and possibly the mayor's office, it appears that on key points, especially this one concerning the testing and funding for getting this done, apparently the mayor's office and the school board, the superintendent, have been able to work together to come out with some really good news on this rapid testing that I think that even the Terry Brady with the local union couldn't criticize, because it benefits everybody to get that testing done, and it's going to be on the school board's dime with the city of Jacksonville apparently supporting that with facilities and funding for it. So it's good news. It's just a bad to have to deal with this state situation when, again, it just appears to be all about politics, making it no bad news. Let's only have good news that comes out about what we're doing to prevent or slow the spread of COVID-19. That's not what the message should be. It should be honest and transparent. And we're simply not getting that all of a sudden from the state administration.
Right. Let's make note of a positive headline, speaking of which, from the week as we move through our top stories here on the show. Amazon has announced it's opening up a new fulfillment center in the city of Jacksonville and adding 500 full-time jobs. Now, this adds to the 5,500 people who already work full-time for Amazon in Northeast Florida. The company does pay a $15 an hour minimum wage. It looks like, according to the Daily Record, who first reported on all of this, that the new fulfillment center could go up at the center at Imeson Park on Jacksonville's north side. Bill Bortsfield, Duval County has unemployment of nearly 10%, mainly due to the pandemic. So any new jobs are good news right now.
Absolutely. This is a real bright spot. And just to confirm, you're absolutely right. I was talking with Daniel Davis over at the Chamber, and first off, we can indeed confirm that will be the location for the new fulfillment center that's going in. And, you know, speaking of the north side, it's a bright spot in the city's economy all around, if you think about it. I mean, because Amazon alone has just been building like crazy up there, and, of course, the Pecan Park Fulfillment Center being the showpiece. But I mean, if you think about it, Wayfair now is getting a big presence in the city. You mentioned our partner, the Daily Record. Of course, they've also reported that Ulta Beauty is accelerating its plan to get its Northwest Jacksonville e-commerce center up and going. So it is good to see that we've got some economic traction, even during the depths of a economic-induced recession from the pandemic here in Jacksonville.
Yeah, and Tim Gibbons, this just speaks to the growth of e-commerce, especially in this pandemic when people are shying away from going places as much as they can.
Yeah, it's a massive shift in the industry, and I was actually talking to some experts this week who are convinced that even whatever shakes out in terms of vaccines or how things return to something like normal, e-commerce isn't going away. It is the trend in industrial real estate. You know, Jacksonville didn't have million square foot warehouses just, you know, scattered around just a couple years ago, and it is now. It's a growing thing nationally. It's a growing thing here. Obviously, it's a good thing not just for the people working at those facilities, but Amazon making this big of a bet on the area, it says something about what other companies might want to come here. And that has knock-on effects as well. You know, you have the port where things come in, you have the plethora of trucking companies that are in the area. So, you know, as a logistics hub, this sort of news has just, you know, ripple effects.
Yeah. Ann Schindler, we're talking about 500 full-time jobs with benefits, $15 an hour minimum wage, although some of the jobs will pay more. That said, Amazon has come in for a lot of criticism for its working conditions at these warehouses and for its business model essentially killing typical traditional retail. So this is sort of a mixed picture when it comes to economic news for Northeast Florida.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me of the debate that surrounded Walmart in, you know, the early days when they were kind of moving into dominance. It's a different model, though. It's interesting. I mean, Amazon, in some ways, is serving kind of more like a middleman for a lot of small businesses now who use it. You know, they access, you know, people, customers access these smaller businesses through Amazon because they have, you know, the systems and everything in place to provide efficient delivery. But yeah, there, you know, as with any company of that scale, you know, there's always going to be concerns about room for improvement, I should say, in terms of, you know, equity and pay and things that, you know, affect employees. I mean, I don't know. I don't think I followed that as closely as some issues, but I also feel like the fact that we're discussing them right now as openly as we are is a little bit different than some of the complaints that seem to be shrouded for years and years when Walmart was having similar complaints. So I don't know what the comparison is. I just think that it seems like a more public debate. It seems a little bit more driven by labor and mm-hmm. that they're getting the attention they need.
Yeah. And let's talk about the Jaguars for a minute. After being released by the team earlier this week, running back Leonard Fournette says he's headed over to Tampa, straight down I-4 to play for the Buccaneers. Now, the team is letting fans back into home games as the new season begins, although there will be a lot of restrictions. And they also announced Tuesday a new initiative to support voter education, registration, and turnout, and release this public service announcement.
It's time to get in the game. Make your voice heard by exercising your right to vote this November. The ballot is your chance to make a difference.
It's your opportunity to make a play.
So get off the sidelines. Visit jaguars.com/vote to get registered.
The choice is yours.
The time is now.
Register to vote by October 5th and get in the game.
Get in the game.
Get in the game.
Get in the game. Be an American.
Fred, what are your thoughts about pro sports like the NFL, the NBA, and other leagues really weighing in on voting and election issues right now, and also the national racial justice movement, which the Jaguars are part of too?
Well, it's hard to criticize a public service announcement that encourages you to do something that is so in line with our republic. And the spots I've seen from the Jaguars has been pretty good. The reports, the comments that have made by Coach Marone on this issue, his talks with the players, is in line with what's happening nationally in all of the leagues. So, you know, it's kind of hard to criticize that, and it's well played. I just feel bad again that once more, for every two steps forward that the Jaguars seem to take in this preseason thing and getting us a winning team, it just seemed to go backwards. By letting Leonard Fournette go, or trading him as it were for whatever reasons and letting him go to Tampa, who's already, by the way, won a Super Bowl, and a couple of our players have already gone down there and gotten Super Bowl rings. One of them is coaching now back with the Jaguars, and several others. It's just puzzling to me how they're going to have a team that is going to win anything in this coming season. And it'd be kind of hard, but unless they're going to pipe in cheering like the NBA does, you know, they pipe in the fans
right.
cheering.
Put cutouts of people in the stands. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do that when I was 5 years old. I make the noise. It is puzzling to us. You know, Minshew is not all. He has to have a team, and he has to have a line, and he has to have a running back. And can any of our panelists name who the top running back is for the Jaguars?
Somebody go. Hey, by the way, it's a 904 day in Jacksonville, September 4th here in the 904. So look for that on social media. And we're out of time, but I want to thank you, Fred Matthews, Bill Bortsfield, Ann Schindler, and Tim Gibbons. Have a great Labor Day weekend, guys. Thanks so much for stopping by here today.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks, Melissa.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, all. Up next, like so many other events this season, Generation W is going virtual. How you can log on and join it after this.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
WJCT Public Media invites you to meet someone you don't agree with politically and get to know their story. It's part of One Small Step, a national project with StoryCorps. Sign up at wjct.org/OSS.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A vaccine before the election? The FDA says it's sticking to the science.
We will not make that decision on the basis of politics. That's a promise.
Stocks take a tumble as America's debt stays on track to balloon to a size not seen since the end of the Second World War. I'm Jen White. We'll see what else has made headlines on the Friday News Roundup. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, in this time of COVID, big events are moving from in-person to virtual, but there's still great content to be viewed and connections you can make. Generation W, a signature women's leadership event in Jacksonville with a global reach, is coming up soon, and you can join online. I spoke about it with Gen W founder, Donna Orender. Donna Orender, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, as always, Melissa. Thank you.
So we're living in a virtual Zoom world these days, everybody is, and that includes your signature event, Generation W. Tell us what's on tap this year and how we'll still be connecting with you even in this time we're living through.
Well, first of all, I love to say in this world of flux,
yeah,
we are all asked to be on immediate flex, and we are flexing along with the world. I also love to say that just because it's a virtual delivery, there is tremendously real impact, and our speakers are just incredible. The themes for this year that you're going to, in 2 weeks, are so on the mark. It addresses the things that we are so interested in, that we are looking for in terms of inspiration and knowledge and connection. And I can give you some insights if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. So, you know, in the area of social and racial justice, Dr. Lapchick, seen as or known as the global conscience of sport, will be back to give a unbelievably compelling talk on the impact of race and social justice over these years. And also, everybody this year is taking the time to give all of us some specific insights and things that we could do if we would choose. We have this amazing panel of incredible leaders, including the CEO of Ancestry.com, who is seeing a tremendous interest in community as people are trying to figure out who their families are and where they're connected. We have the managing director of Finsbury, which is a international crisis communication company. We have, of course, Pat Garrity, who's been on our stage many times, but such an innovative, incredible leader, thinker. And our last member of that panel is Dr. Olinda Johnson, who teaches leadership at the United States Naval War College. And they're going to tell us what they're seeing, and more than that, what they're feeling. And then what they're doing, right? They run big organizations, but they're also people in their own right. And that combination of not only big, massive leadership, but personal leadership is of interest to us all. And I'm really excited about what they are going to not only draw out of each other, but share with us in terms of as we are still trying to figure out, all of us, like we can't see around the corner, but it's really hard to even see straight ahead.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, we've got lots of small talks, but I do have to say Dr. Eager is coming back. She mesmerized everyone last year, 92 years old, a Holocaust survivor, a psychologist, an author. You know, when you hear her speak, who has lived through so much, you look at her and said, well, she can do that, so can I. And I will tell you, in this time, I think we all need to feel that.
Yeah, we do. I mean, so a strong focus on leadership and connection and being positive, which can be hard.
Correct.
But I think that is a big theme for this year. How can people access all of this great content and be part of it?
Well, you can go to our website, genwnow.com. There will be a place for you to register. It is a dynamic program we really looked at the technology. We surveyed 25 companies and really tried to figure out how do we make that come to life, knowing that we're all sitting in front of a screen. And so there'll be times to get up. There'll be times to like shake a little bit and dance. There will be the energetic video, music, thought provocative things that we generally do when people come to see us. We'll have ways to, for you to connect with people for sure. And so really it's just a function now of people registering. Let's see, we started at 11 o'clock East Coast time to make it available for both Europe and the West Coast now that we have such a big following. And we're excited about really engaging people in a time of connection when it's more important than ever.
So a global audience for Gen W Vision 2020, September 11th, kicking off virtually at 11 a.m. And, you know, this is a global event that Jacksonville hosts. And so it's important that people kind of, you know, they give props to that, because you do bring people in from all over the world, and you've got a big community, which is cool, Donna. And I want to give you all the congrats for that.
Well, we appreciate it. We have people registered from India. We have people registered from Africa, which is really cool. Listen, we are so proud of digging our roots deep in this community, in Jacksonville and in the Northeast Florida region. And when we started it, that was our goal, is to dig deep roots, but also to speak nationally and internationally. And the fact that we can bring all of these people together, right, from around our orb here is really exciting. Really, really exciting. And so we're appreciative for all the people that come from our region, from the state of Florida. But like many companies have told us, wow, we can now share this goodness with our employees and our colleagues from across the country and then beyond. So, yeah, you know, that is really exciting, Melissa, I have to say.
Yeah. So register now at genwnow.com. The fun kicks off Friday, September 11th. Donna Orender, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
And if you register, you will have select access to an exclusive post-event in addition to all of the Gen W Vision 2020 content. And you'll be supporting a national nonprofit that is working to lift up women and girl leadership. So check it out. I'm Melissa Ross. This is our show. Make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup, a live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories across Florida. And everybody have a safe and happy Labor Day weekend. We'll be back Tuesday at 9 a.m. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.